from the advertising media capital of the world, New Milford, Connecticut, wherever that is. This is Mostly Marketing with Matt Wilson.
Oh, thank you. Welcome to another episode of Mostly Marketing with Matt Wilson. And thanks to my buddy there, Jim McCarthy, jimmccarthyvoiceovers.com, who, by the way, I haven't seen in 5 years. Hung out with him last night in New York City. It was awesome. Except for the Times Square shooting that happened while I was right there. But other than that, it was awesome. So thank you, Jim McCarthy, jimmccarthyvoiceovers.com. Get him to do the intro to your podcast. He's awesome. By the way, Mostly Automotive Marketing presented by Silverback Advertising, silverbackadvertising.com. I was in the Starbucks line this morning. I was getting my grande iced brown sugar oat milk shaken espresso. Don't judge me. It's good. It's delicious. Get off my case. And I saw the most beautiful SUV. And it was the first time I've seen one in town. It was the Rivian R1S, which is the like SUV that Rivian came out with. I've seen the pickup truck before. It was one, there's like one in my little town. I see him around. I know it's the same guy, and it's awesome. But I've never seen the SUV one before. Super nice looking. Did a little research. Range seems pretty good. It just seems like a really cool car. And I'll transition that into saying that, you know, no secret, right? I'm digital operations manager at Silverback Advertising, and we have lots of clients who are marketing, whether at their own free will or at the direction of their OEM, marketing their EV lineup. But the marketing for the EVs is a little bit different, right? It's not the same as gas-powered cars. So I thought that'd be a good topic to discuss. And so to discuss that, I figured we better bring in somebody that's got more credibility than me. So we brought in the vice president, account planning and lead of industry solutions. Automotive vice president, account planning and lead of industry solutions. Yes. The acronym is like Alisapolis or something. It's a very long job title, but anyway, his name is, Jim Johnson, and we'll bring him in right now. Welcome to the podcast, Jim. How are you?
Thanks, Matt. I'm doing great. And yourself?
I'm doing great. You got a really long title there. Mine is like Dom and yours is like Avpiapolis and something.
Yeah, you know, as I've progressed in my career, I decided to sort of maintain all the titles I've ever had.
Just add on.
Exactly.
A lot of people, when they change jobs and get promoted, they get a new title, but you're just making your title longer.
I have some baggage, and I carry it with me at all times.
So let's talk a little bit about EVs, right? We'll talk about it at its simplest form first, and then we'll get into some of the good stuff. But at its simplest form, how is EV marketing different from marketing regular air quotes, gas-powered vehicles?
It's a fundamental shift in how we behave as consumers, really. So it's what the sociologists call a discontinuous innovation. So we have to change our behavior very drastically in order to realize the true benefits of EVs, right? So the marketing is far more educational in nature. So for what we do, we generally kind of try to sell people on the idea of owning an EV and its benefits before we even start talking about the car itself. We're still in that phase where, you know, the early adopters in mostly California have bought their Teslas. We're starting to kind of move into the early majority phase, which is, you know, people who aren't quite as tech savvy, maybe not as affluent or coastal, so they don't really have a good sense of what they're getting into mostly. So it's a far more educational play than a nice engine. I mean, we're so used to driving around our suburban towns and filling up at the gas station. We're asking people to make a real fundamental shift in behavior. So we have to treat the marketing and advertising accordingly.
That makes sense. Because listen, you don't have to convince somebody that they need a Nissan Altima because it's all-wheel drive and they're Nissan buyers. They live in the Northeast. They know they need an all-wheel drive vehicle. And, you know, it's fine. I'm going to get it, or I'm going to get a Camry, or I'm going to get a, you know, whatever. The equivalent, the Toyota equivalent as they go across. But with an EV, like you said, I think your challenge is selling somebody on the EV life and the range and the battery life, and you're almost convincing them you need an EV before you're convincing them that you need an Ioniq or an EV6 or, you know, whatever they're called.
Yeah. Yeah. You're really selling them in the lifestyle. It's a massive shift in behavior, and a lot of people are sort of hung up on it, right? It used to be about price mostly. They're relatively expensive compared to a normal, you know, internal combustion engine. Price is starting to come down, so it's maybe not as much a factor. There's a lot of federal incentives as well as state level incentives, so price parity is almost there. The real hang up for people, I think, is just the charging infrastructure and the idea that you have to charge a vehicle versus just, you know, drive around and fill up when you need it. So that's,
yeah,
it's going to take some time.
Do you think that education is the responsibility of tier one, or is the onus on the tier three level dealers doing that education? Because a lot of times with gas powered vehicles, at least from my experience when I was the marketing director at a Nissan group, is you tell everybody how amazing the Pathfinder is, and I'll tell them what price I can get them a Pathfinder for. Is that still the same with EVs, or are the dealers tier three having to do that educating, lifting some of that?
Yeah, so I think it's going to be both. The tier one will probably sell the dream itself. Mm-hmm. Tier three is going to do a lot of the heavy lifting on the sort of in-market local education. I actually think that, you know, a lot of these incumbent OEMs, Ford, GM, Toyota, with these really robust dealer networks, have a real strong opportunity to get mass adoption going. You look at Tesla and Rivian and Lucid and those sort of direct-to-consumer models that are mostly online. They have their showrooms, but they don't necessarily have a dealer network. I think they're at a somewhat of a disadvantage as, again, that market moves into the early majority. You have these people who have been going to the same dealership for two or three vehicles. They have that trust embedded. Yeah. They know the salespeople by name. That's going to be huge, I think, for a lot of these incumbent OEMs to really take advantage of that and reach out proactively to consumers now and say, hey, you know, we can actually get you up to speed on what it's like to own an EV, how to charge it, the best idea, the service, right? What kind of service you might need. Let's do that up front, even before you're in the showroom, to try to get you on our short list of people interested in EV. So it's going to be both, but I do think the dealers kind of, the onus is on them to be proactive about it.
That's tough too, I think, because from a lot of tier three dealers are very accustomed to the low funnel marketing approach and the branding awareness or educational approach, not only having budget allocated to that, but also creative allocated to, or social creative also content allocated to like a branding awareness educational campaign. In my experience, it's not really what dealers tend to focus on in their marketing.
Yeah, exactly. It's a lot of retail-focused messaging. It's offers, incentives, things like that, local inventory. I think that's going to be part of it. Obviously, you have to kind of fund future adoption. But really, there has to be a two-pronged approach, and it has to be a proactive one. We can't rely on people sort of figuring it out for themselves. Again, if we're really trying to get mass adoption at scale, there's going to have to be outreach. So whether it's, you know, tapping into your CRM database or looking at people who might be nearing an end of lease, I think it's incumbent upon both tier one, again, to sell the lifestyle and the dream. Here's what it's like to own an EV, and the dealers to do that education on the nuts and bolts of it, right? Here's exactly what you need to do when you own an EV. Here's your local charging infrastructure. Here's what you need to do to service it. We're at your disposal for any questions you have. There's going to be a lot of handholding, I think, with that next cohort of adoption. Mm-hmm. And the dealers are really kind of where the rubber meets the road, so to speak, as they've always been.
Before, let's go back a few minutes. I called it a Rivian, and you called it a Rivian. Have I been saying it wrong for years?
No, I tend to use a more aristocratic tone.
Oh, how nice.
Yes,
an
exactly.
Aristocrat on the show. I like it.
There's a strong possibility we're both saying it wrong. So
yeah, that's a good point. Years ago, when the Nissan Leaf first came out, and I was working at my group, I took a Leaf home one night, and I live like, I don't know, I lived at the time like maybe 20, 25, 30 miles away from the dealership. And it was in the winter. And I drove home, stopped at Target on the way home, which was not really out of the way, and then went home, didn't charge the Leaf overnight. Lived in a condo at the time, didn't really have a way to charge it. And then it was freezing the next morning and I was blowing through battery power. And I was looking at how, you know, I had my phone on my like Waze. So I knew how many miles till I get back to the dealership. And I was looking at how many miles the Leaf was telling me I had left on my range. And the math was not mathing up, right? Mm-hmm. So I had turned the heat off and I was like, it had the heat of the steering wheel, which power came from the solar panel on the back of the roof. So I'm like on top of the steering wheel to stay warm. It was New England, 22 degree New England January day. And eventually when you get low enough, the distance to empty, I guess, you know, just shows like dashes. Like, well, we're not going to calculate it because we don't really know what's going to happen. So I was like, oh crap, I got 3 miles left of charge and 6 miles to go. And I'm like, oh my God, I'm going to be on the side of the road. I'm going to have to get an electric vehicle towed through the market back to the dealership. What a great way to market this electric vehicle. I'm on the phone with the service manager, who's my buddy, freaking out. And I made it back, right? Nice. I made it back and I was like, that's it. I'm done. I will go back to my Ultima demo now. Yes. So I had the range anxiety. What's the biggest challenge in the education of EVs? Is it the range anxiety or is it something else?
Yeah, that's a big part of it. I think we're so used to like staring at our cell phones on, you know, 10% battery and freaking out that it's going to die.
Oh, I hate that.
You know, yes, it always happens to me too. And you take a screenshot and your friends will always remind you, hey man, you need to charge your phone.
Yeah.
That's a big part of it. But if you look at sort of like daily commuting activity, that's why plug-in hybrids are so viable now.
Yeah.
You get 30 to 40 miles of range on electric battery only. That's usually what people travel on a daily basis when they commute to work or school or wherever. So I think it's a little bit overblown. People are thinking about, well, I have 300 miles of range. What if I need to take a trip to, you know, my grandparents, one state away, I'm going to run out halfway through. And, you know, those trips are kind of few and far between. Like how often is it that you actually drive 300 miles? So yeah, I think there's a couple of ways to tackle that. It's, you know, being real with consumers and asking them the question, how far do you drive and how often?
Yeah.
And if it's, you know, something you could probably last a week on a full charge in most vehicles these days with everyday driving activity. The other part is just sort of the local charging infrastructure. So one of the things we're doing is we're actually embedding charging map locations within our creative units. So we have video and then charging locations near you. And that's serving to just give people an idea of where the local chargers are. And by the way, which ones are compatible with your vehicle? Because that's another big part. It's like some of them aren't compatible with your vehicle. Some of them aren't well-maintained. The infrastructure is not quite there yet. And I think that's been a big barrier to adoption so far. The whole, we always talk about this Model T moment for EVs. Price is starting to get there, so it's more affordable. But the reason why the Model T was so successful is that real estate conspired, the highway system was built out, all these different forces conspired to make the automobile viable. And I think the same thing needs to happen for EVs to have that Model T moment. We're not quite there yet on the infrastructure side of things.
I mean, in my town, we have a gas station with like a Sonic, and they've got, you know, maybe 10 Tesla chargers. And then down by the mall, you know, like 40 minutes south of me, there's, you know, probably 20 Tesla chargers. And then I know in town here, there's a, I think by town hall, there's a, you know, like just a regular EV charger, but I don't really know. I know it's in town. I don't know where it is. It's not marked off. This doesn't have any signage. The Tesla chargers, you know, when you're driving, you have the Tesla chargers. This is probably the stupidest question that you're going to get today, but the Tesla chargers work on other EVs or is it just on Teslas?
Yeah, they do. Yeah, they absolutely do.
Okay.
Yeah.
I didn't know
that. For sure. You know, and Tesla's going to be a major player in the charging station rollout. There has to be a lot of private enterprise that kind of gets involved. We have an over-reliance, I think, on government entities and federal support for this stuff. So, you know, both forces are kind of coming together and figuring this out. Interstate, they're looking to retrofit certain gas stations with EV chargers, but we're going to have to start thinking a little bit more about where and when we charge. So there's another company out there, it's called Amped, but they're in the Bay Area of San Francisco and they do something really cool. And they actually just literally have a battery swap station. So rather than sit there and wait 10, 15 minutes to charge your vehicle, they just swap the battery out in 5 minutes. And they can also come to you while you're at work or whatever. So I think these alternate models and modes of charging and battery infrastructure are going to be more viable. And that's really an interesting way to think about it.
Yeah.
It's like, you know, if I'm somewhere and I need a charge and there's not a charger, there might be an option for someone like AAA to come and swap it out for you. And you don't have to feel like you're going to get towed through a Target in the most embarrassing fashion ever.
Yeah. The big group of people who are anti-EV, the maybe not crazies, maybe not that far, but the people who are, you know, hey, listen, the coal may make your batteries as bad for the environment as the whatever. Like, do we try and market to those people, or are we like, listen, they're here, they're not getting an EV, they're in Louisiana, whatever, not to generalize, but are we trying to talk to those people about it, or is it no? We're talking to the people who are in the markets that they might be interested, the type of person who might be interested, and we're just ignoring that other set.
Yeah, kind of the laggards of technology. Everybody has a detractor. You know, it's interesting. EVs have kind of become politicized as well. You certainly
see. So dumb.
doesn't make any sense, but no. Everything's politicized these days, right? You take a stance on one thing and, you know, you own an EV and Jay Leno said, all of a sudden you're a vegan, you know, you do yoga 6 times a week. It's just like, okay, we put you in buckets. I don't think so. I personally wouldn't focus on that particular cohort for a while. If they're people who are actively detractors, they're probably not necessarily worth the time. They might be worth the education though, right? So comparing ICE ownership to EVs in the sense that you're going to save money over the long term, maybe that's an appeal to them. There are, I think, different ways to sort of position EVs as an alternative to ICE vehicles that makes sense for certain people. I think cost of ownership is probably a big one for those people who look at EVs as, you know, expensive and only for coastal elites. There's a lot of bias around EV ownership. Yeah. And it's largely due to Tesla and Elon Musk and all that other stuff. And it's like, how do we rid ourselves of that baggage? We talk, you know, practical brass tacks with certain people like that. It's going to cost you less money over the long term.
Yeah. I've thought about it. Like, would I be interested in getting an EV? How would it fit into my life? And I think if I was to do it, it would fit into my life as a second car. Mm-hmm. But so I'll tow a trailer or a boat or something with my SUV. But how many times a year do I really, like you said, do I do that? I go to the Adirondacks once a year and I tow my boat up there. Couldn't do it with an EV probably because of the mileage. And there's no charging stations where we are, the Adirondacks, the middle of nowhere. And those are the people who, you know, are like, there's an elitist New Englander with his EV coming upstate, you know, whatever. So I'm like, all right, so it can't be my only vehicle. And I live in a small town that doesn't have a ton of infrastructure, but also, like, you know, my kids' schools aren't that far away. The grocery store's not that far away. The hospital's not that far away. My in-laws aren't that far away. Like, I could probably, like you said, go a week driving around town to baseball practice and stuff and not charge my EV and only use my gas-guzzling Jeep when I need it, right? Or when it's snowing or raining or whatever, or I need to go somewhere with a third row. Like, it could fit, get an EV as a nanny car or just a second, you know, fun vehicle. Like, that's how it would fit into my life personally, right? And is that a plausible way for dealers to market it as well? Like, hey, this doesn't have to, the range sucks. It doesn't have to be your only vehicle. Lots of households have more than one car.
Yeah, exactly. I think the media tends to, and we're both journalists, right? The media tends to hang up on these really edge cases. And there was an article in the Wall Street Journal, and it was talking about this guy who was trying to drive from like Louisiana to Michigan, and he couldn't find enough charging infrastructure along the routes that he was traveling. That's why EVs aren't viable. How many times in your life do you drive across 15 states, you know, in the matter of a week?
Yeah, I've done it like twice in my entire life. In 44 years, maybe twice.
Yep. Yeah, exactly. I did it from LA to North Carolina this summer when I moved out.
That sounds horrible.
It was horrible. It was 1,000 degrees every day. I had twins, 3-year-olds, and a dog in the car. Wouldn't recommend it. It's the last move of my life.
Yeah.
Anyhow, I would just say, you know, if you have to focus on the more practical aspects of ownership, I think that all these edge cases, again, get overblown in the media. People hear these horror stories about getting stranded in the desert. They're really just those stories that tend to get overblown. And really, if you think about, I think we have to, as dealers especially, and as marketers, we have to educate consumers on thinking about their daily usage patterns, thinking about the facts that EVs are incredibly viable. And oh, by the way, if you still have this hang up on running out of charge, there are plug-in hybrids. And plug-in hybrids, I think, are an excellent bridge. You know, you kind of get that behavioral shift of charging the vehicle and you get used to that, but you also have the backup option of it switches over to gas if you run out of charge. I think that is a really interesting idea for a lot of OEMs and dealers to give the choice, right?
Yeah. I've thought about that.
Yep. I think it's really, especially now, for the next maybe 5 to 7 years, plug-in hybrids to me are probably the way to go for most people.
Yeah.
Certainly those who have a lot of anxiety. You know, we're an anxiety ridden society.
Yeah,
these
for
days,
sure. So. When you talk about the plug-in hybrid, like, that would fit into my life too. You know, if my hybrid motor gets 20 miles, let's say, whatever, I don't know what they would be. And Jeep, I'm a Jeep guy and Jeep's got one now and they're coming out with another one. And like, okay, so I could do all my around town stuff probably and make it back home without using gas, charge it, and repeat the next day. Last night, I had to go to the city to see Jim McCarthy, my big voice guy. And all right, well, I got a gas-powered car, and I would have been fine. I would have gotten down to 684. My hybrid motor would have been dead or whatever you call it. And then I would have been fine on another 400 miles of gas down to the city and back. And then I would have charged it overnight. This morning, driving to Starbucks to get my fancy drink, wouldn't have used any gas. And so I feel like people who are skeptics, maybe that, like you said, that may be the bridge to like, all right, well, let me get used to the idea, you know?
Yeah, like I said, it's behavioral shift. I mean, there's so many different books about habits, like forming habits, and it's these small things you do every day that sort of build up to a massive behavioral shift. I feel like the plug-in hybrid is our best way. If there are still a lot of skeptics out there, market those as you're still doing the right thing in terms of getting with the times, and then also the environmental factor.
Yeah.
You're going to save a lot of money on gas, et cetera. So you can sort of build up a pretty interesting use case. And then break down those barriers where you're never going to get stranded because it's the same thing as having a nice engine, but those short-term, you know, trips around town, you're not going to use any gas. It's going to be extremely efficient. And if you have a home charger, you don't even have to look around for charging stations because the reality is you're not going to charge a plug-in hybrid very often at public infrastructure. So
probably not.
You know, most people do charge at home, and I think that's kind of the best use case for something like a plug-in.
Is the charge at home a challenge too? Like you can, I know with the old Leaf, you could trickle charge through a regular plug, or we had a promotion once where like, you know, we would put money towards getting an actual like level two, whatever it was called back then, charger. Is that another challenge? Like how am I going to charge at home and it's going to make my electric bill go up? And like, that's got to be another frequent objection.
It is. Yeah. I think there's a lot of OEMs right now that are looking at packaging it together. So if you buy a new EV, they'll go ahead and pay for the install or give you credits for, you know, charging and things like that. So they're definitely addressing those objections, you know, upfront. But most, you know, the research still suggests that most people who own EVs are homeowners. Part of that is because they're inherently a little bit more affluent.
Sure.
But the other part of it is just easier to charge at home than it is to find, especially in urban areas. And that's where I think, like, you know, I said that model before with battery swapping, there's going to be a lot of interesting business models that come out of especially urban environments where people live in apartments and they can't access those chargers. That's where the next wave of adoption and innovation has to happen.
So we know in automotive that the customer journey from, you know, first ad delivered to car purchased is not 5 days, right? It's not, I hear my radio commercial on Tuesday and they buy a car on Saturday. It's 45, 65, 90 days, whatever. Mm-hmm. How long is that time frame for EVs? Is it longer? It must be longer.
Yeah, so far it is longer. Yeah, there's just so much more to consider. Again, it's, you know, with a nice vehicle, generally you're kind of on to weighing out the features and benefits of the vehicle at the initial stages. Whereas the EV piece, it's that educational factor. It's like, I don't really know, especially with the incentives. There's so many different state level incentives. Mm-hmm. It's really hard to know exactly which vehicles apply for the federal tax incentives right now. It keeps getting updated. There's a list on the IRS website. I don't know about you. I don't really hang out on the IRS.gov website.
Not usually.
I can avoid that. Yeah.
Yeah.
I'm more into Paw Patrol these days.
Yeah.
But
I hear you. I'm graduated from Paw Patrol. It's SpongeBob at my house now, but
man, I need that. I need to put on that cap because it's getting old.
Yeah.
So, you know, it's just really being upfront about it. I think we have to just say, hey, you know, you live in Illinois, you have the state credit available to you in addition to the federal tax credit. That's going to bring the barrier to entry way down. It's really just the educational piece, I think, has to be front and center always in the marketing. And that's not going to change for a while. I think until we get to 30 or 40% adoption here in the US, we're at 10% now. We kind of have to take that approach.
So when marketing EVs, are you finding that there's a different media mix or types of media or tactics that are more effective with the education process of these vehicles?
Yeah, digital first, certainly CTV has been a really useful tool for us. You know, it's tech savvy, still pretty relatively affluent folks who like to access content that's curated, that type of thing. These are the folks who are buying EVs right now. And certainly digital media lends itself very well to that. So we've been focusing on CTV, digital video, and then mobile as well. We're focusing on household. So knowing that household, buying a car is definitely a household decision.
Sure.
And certainly one that everyone needs to weigh in on, including the kids now. A lot of these vehicles now, really the point of differentiation is the interior. So what kind of tech is embedded? What type of connected services you have? Are there USBs in the backseat? All that kind of stuff.
Yeah,
so,
right.
Yeah, it is a different media mix for sure. Probably a little bit lighter on the linear side of things. You know, just demographically speaking, we know that linear is generally, 50 plus is who's kind of consuming linear. So it's definitely digital first. Again, you can kind of put more educational content within digital formats. It's at their fingertips. It's easy to navigate. It's really hard to cram that type of information into a TV spot, for example.
Right.
Right. So again, we're digital first, we're mobile and desktop and CTV primarily because it reaches a younger, more affluent consumer. And we can kind of put all those educational pieces together and then drive to the dealer who can answer those questions about what's on lot today.
Yeah.
All in one experience, right?
And I think with connected TV too, if you're working on, if you have a campaign for a Kia dealer who's marketing, it's Kia EV6 maybe it's called?
Yep,
EV6. If they're marketing EV6, you can, connected TV over linear, you can drill down on audiences for people who are interested in electric vehicles or researching the specific EV6 or researching the vehicles that are in the same category as the EV6 and have less waste in your spend than a spot that somebody who's in market for Kia. In market for Kia and in market for electric Kia are two different audiences. It's not
100%.
And the same thing with linear. Linear, there's a lot of waste in that spend there. You're going to hit people who have no chance of buying an electric vehicle.
Yeah. Yeah, something like 4 or 5% of people, the population, buys a vehicle in any given year, and that's probably going to decline as we kind of mature mm-hmm. out. So, the inherent targeting and the digital capabilities of CTV, they enable a lot of things that linear can't, and billboards can't, and all the traditional media can't. And it's a limited waste, but it's also again, it can incorporate a lot more information. And a lot more sort of like lean forward type of information. So
yeah.
You get more of an active consumer, one that's actively engaging with the content versus a lean back. EV adoption is not necessarily a very lean back experience right now. So
yeah.
That's the tack we've been taking. CTV, it's targeted, it's local, and it's extremely relevant to a younger consumer who we kind of need to get on board with this.
Taking a step back and looking at it from 30,000 feet before we wrap it up, how does this affect our industry as a whole, and then also the marketing in our industry as a whole, like in the next 5 years, 5 to 7 years.
In terms of the EV adoption?
Yeah. Yes. Sorry. Great question, so, Matt. Really professional broadcast question. Way to zero in.
So it's going to cost a lot of money, first of all, right? So we've been talking a lot about how to balance the two, right? So you need short-term profit, quite frankly, in order to fund these future electrification efforts. So we're kind of taking a two-pronged approach of get the people who are in market today to consider your vehicles that you have in your current lineup. Use that as your profit center and get them into that loyalty loop. And then when you develop an EV solution that's viable for the market and also affordable, then we can start to engage with current owners of your brand with EV marketing, kind of like a trickle approach, right? So we don't necessarily blast them with it, but if they own a Kia, for example, and it's an ICE vehicle, we'll continuously feed them information about how Kia is innovating specifically through EVs. I think it's incumbent upon OEMs to look at their first party data sets and their,
sure.
and their loyalty and start to introduce this concept today rather than just relying on that mass messaging and mass marketing to everyone. The easiest way to get a new customer is to talk to your current customers, right? So mm-hmm. moving them kind of up into your EV ownership is probably the least barrier to entry because they're already familiar with your brand. They trust your brand. I think that's going to be the best way to go. So that's kind of what we're doing with a lot of our partners. First party data, yeah. Focus on your current customers.
Melissa Hubbard, who is the director of research for this highly acclaimed podcast, tells me that you have twin three-year-olds. Is that true?
It is true. Yeah. And currently in market for a plug-in hybrid, if you know any dealers.
I don't. No, I'm just kidding. I know a lot. So twin three-year-olds, is bedtime like just chaos at your house?
It's total madness. Every day is relative chaos. Very limited control over kind of what happens.
Yeah.
So we've outfitted the garage specifically with a lot of foam padding, We have some mats down, and they just kind of wrestle it out. And then when they get tired of wrestling, they watch Paw Patrol, and so do
yeah.
I. So,
yeah.
It's a virtuous cycle.
Yeah. I specifically built a playroom when I built my house to have somewhere to put the children. And, you know, when they were little, that didn't work. But now that they're 10 and 7, I find that I can say, go to the playroom. The adults are talking. And they will go to the playroom. And it seems to be working. And everybody tells me, though, when they're 15, they're going to lock themselves in their rooms anyway. I'm never going to see them. So.
Exactly. Enjoy this time while you have it. I hear that all the time. We live in a community that's a lot of retirees, and they see the boys and it's like, oh, it's so sweet. You know, enjoy this time. And it's hard to relate, right? Because you're in the moment and you're kind of just trying to survive.
Yeah.
But it's the coolest thing ever. I mean, they're three now. They're starting to really get into sports and fishing and all sorts of cool stuff that I like to do. So it's been a journey, and we had them right in the middle of COVID, April 2020. So that was the weirdest time ever to have children.
Yeah.
But we've luckily they won't remember a thing about it. And I barely do too. So
that's
over that hump, and it's been great.
Growing up with the last name Wilson, you know, I had to deal with Mr. Wilson, which I still deal with now. So that being said, were you often compared to or teased for either Jimmy Johnson, the football coach, or Jimmy Johnson, the 7-time NASCAR champion?
You know, both of those guys have a pretty impressive resume.
Yeah.
So I kind of take it as a compliment. I'm like, yeah, man, you can call me Jimmy Johnson and compare me to those guys all day. There's a jazz musician named Jimmy Johnson. Funny thing is, I won't belabor this this point, but my name is so ubiquitous that there's a criminal who lives in Philadelphia. So when I go to get the DMV to get my license renewed every year or every 4 years, that pops up, and they don't give me my license until I prove my innocence every time.
Jeez. Nothing like having a name where you could Google it and never know what's going to come up.
Exactly. Yeah. Needle in a haystack.
Before I let you go, where are you from? You said you just moved to East Coast.
Wilmington, North Carolina. So I'm originally from Salem, New Hampshire.
Okay.
And I was.
Are you a Patriots fan?
Big Patriots fan.
Let's go. Yes. Me too.
Celtics, Bruins, Sox, all that stuff. So I was in the Marine Corps after high school in Jacksonville, North Carolina, which is just up the road from where I live now in Wilmington.
Okay.
So I kind of returned to some roots over here, but I was in New York for a while, in Boston, working for ad agencies, moved to LA for 12 years. Now I'm back East Coast, closer to family, and the boys can have grandma and grandpa come down whenever they want.
That. That's important. Yeah. Well, Jim, I appreciate it. I really enjoyed our conversation. I always like when I have a podcast guest where I enjoy the conversation and want to do it again, because there's some guests you have, I'm not going to name any names, where you're like, this person must be really fun at parties. Like, kind of let's end this now. So I really do. I really sincerely enjoyed it for sure.
Excellent. Yeah, this has been great. Thank you, Matt, for having me.
All right. Thanks so much, Jim. A very good discussion with Jim Johnson, the guy with the longest title ever, the Automotive Vice President, Account Planning and Lead of Industry Solutions at VDX.TV. I got to tell you, for me, if you're going to fit it into your life, I am continuously thinking that a hybrid would be something that would work for me. You know, I'm a Jeep guy, and I got the third row one now, and I love it. But this two-row versions coming out with a hybrid, and it's definitely appealing. People tell me that you're supposed to promote your podcast at the end of your podcast. So, you know, like and follow, and they say cheesy stuff like smash the subscribe button, but that's all kind of cheesy, so I'm not going to say that. But if you want to follow me. I put out episodes as often as I can. Mostly Marketing Matt Wilson, brought to you by Silverback Advertising. Thanks for listening. Appreciate it.
Mostly Automotive Marketing with Matt Wilson is brought to you by... Wait, this guy has sponsors? Oh, never mind. This sheet of paper's blank. No sponsors. That makes more sense. For updates, info, future episodes, and more, follow on Twitter, subscribe on YouTube, like on Facebook, and connect on Frackle. You guys made that last one up. That's not even a thing, Frackle. Come on.